we've seen some pretty impressive advances in our understanding of the renormalization group flow. And most of these advances sort of make use of the fact that when you study, let's say, some UV complete quantum field theory, and you go to very short distances, the theory typically simplifies, right? And you have some CFT. And in the CFT, there's some simple set of data, some numerical data that characterizes properties of the CFT. And if you're clever enough to pick the right data, then you can potentially say things even away from the CFT. So in particular, in four dimensions, if you study one of the conformal anomalies, the A anomaly, the so-called A anomaly, Komar, Gotsky, and Schwimmer recently proved that as you go to long distances, that number that's large at short distances becomes smaller. And in three dimensions, there's also this similar quantity F, which seems to obey some similar inequality. There are a lot of reasons to believe that this is probably not the whole story. In other words, that there may be additional constraints. So one way to motivate that is if you simply study some subset of theories, you're not so ambitious as to study the most general UV complete quantum field theories, but you study some subset of those theories, perhaps with more symmetry, like supersymmetry or something else, there's reason to believe that maybe there should be additional quantities that might decrease or might constrain the theory even more. Or maybe even the quantities that are described in the A theorem, like could obey some stronger inequalities, not just that AUV is bigger than AIR, but AUV is bigger than AIR plus something. Finally, another reason to think that there's more going on is just that conformal field theories are extremely constrained objects. So the numerical data of a CFT is not just some random collection of numbers. They obey a lot of interesting constraints on their own, coming from the conformal bootstrap, coming from so-called conformal collider physics, and other things. So in this talk, kind of what I want to do is suggest that these additional constraints in the CFT have something to say, even away from the fixed point, at least in certain classes of theories. Of course, to use these kinds of constraints away from criticality, you need some you need to ask the right kinds of questions. But in any case, we'll ask some very specialized questions, and we'll try to argue that this stuff from the CFT, these bootstrap constraints actually tell you something away from criticality. So just the basic overview. I'll be thinking in terms of theory space, which is a pretty nebulous concept, but I'll explain some basic facts about it and why we care about it. I'll focus then on some special points in theory space, the conformal field theories. I'll explain the important data for a conformal field theory and the constraints that this data obeys, and which subset of those constraints will be important for us later on. I'll move to discuss flows away from the CFT, where you introduce some mass scale, you introduce some relevant deformation, and I'll discuss studying what happens away from those fixed points, where you probe sort of some non-trivial submanifold of the full theory space. And then I'll spend the rest of the talk talking about the main point of this talk, which is to understand sort of how, if you like, repulsive superconformal field theories are in the space of theories. So basically, the idea is you start with some superconformal field theory, you turn on some relevant deformation, and you want to know, essentially, if it's possible to have some parametrically close by CFTs that are connected by the RG flow. So I'll explain how that question can be understood in different classes of supersymmetric theories. So in n equals 1 theories, it's clearly true, as I'll explain, that you can have parametrically close fixed points. In n equals 4 theories, it's clearly not the case, at least if there are no sort of exotic non-Lagrangian n equals 4 theories. And the basic reason is that the n equals 4 theory is essentially specified, apart from some marginal gauge coupling, by some gauge group, some discrete data. But for n equals 2 theories, it's a much more interesting question. And I'll just try to argue that The answer is no, that n equals 2 theories can't be parametrically close to each other if they're connected by relevant deformation. And that constraints from the bootstrap and bounds on A over C by Hoffman-Maldacena and this kind of stuff actually sort of forbid this from happening in some way. Okay, so the basic idea is that theory space is some kind of manifold, M, and some point P in theory space is some quantum field theory. And of course, you can consider different submanifolds with different properties, submanifolds that have supersymmetry, don't have supersymmetry, whatever. And the way to gain some traction is just to pick a particular point P, and generally it's easier to study if P is a CFT, and you study deformations of this P. So you imagine deforming the theory by adding, if you like, to the Lagrangian some lambda I OI. I mean, the theory doesn't really have to have a Lagrangian description. This has some meaning of basically inserting in correlation functions this deformation, e to the minus this thing. But these deformations basically parameterize the normal directions from this point. And generally speaking, if we're studying the RG flow around some particular CFT, Wilsonian analysis suggests that we can sort of ignore all the sort of infinitely many highly irrelevant directions away from that theory. But there are, of course, many subtleties. I mean, this space is presumably infinite dimensional. Dualities act on it in a very non-trivial way, right? I mean, you have, for example, in n equals 1 theory, you have super QCD, you have the electric and magnetic descriptions, which look very different at short distances, but at long distances, they're the same theory. So somehow there are some transformations that act on this space, some associations on this space that are very non-trivial. And also, the thing to keep in mind is that since it's a manifold, you know, and you're writing down some coordinates, these lambda I, you have to be careful that what you say, anything that you say, is coordinate invariant. If you like, in more traditional language, this means that it's independent of the particular renormalization scheme. And of course, the topology and geometry of this space are highly non-trivial, and I'll have absolutely nothing interesting to say about the global structure of this space. I don't understand what the global structure is, but we'll just have some things to say about the local structure. So one particularly useful point of view is to, if we treat it as a manifold and we pick some particular point P, we can talk about a patch that sort of surrounds that point P, right? So if we have some manifold, say some sphere, we have some point P, which is a CFT, then we can have some kind of patch around P. And this patch is essentially a patch where the physics is basically essentially smooth, where the number of degrees, where the degrees of freedom are essentially the same. So for example, you have the conformal window of super QCD, where you start from some prefixed point in the UV, and you flow to some interacting fixed point in the infrared. The interacting fixed point, of course, is slightly different than the UV one, but it's still written in terms of the same degrees of freedom, the, for example, electric quarks and gluons. As you change the number of flavors and number of colors, of course, this description breaks down, unitarity breaks down, and you have to go to a different description in terms of the magnetic degrees of freedom, and this is in some other patch of the theory space. So, so one question is why should we care? I mean, one basic reason is just to organize our abstract thinking about laws of QFT. And since this is a particle physics talk, I mean, formulating these laws can even be useful even in the real world, right? So right now at the LHC, we seem to be in a position where we have a 125, 26 GeV Higgs boson and no explanation for why it is that way. And so maybe understanding something about this structure of the space of theories will give us some new explanations of naturalness, or maybe some different notions of what naturalness actually means, or minimality, or whatever. Maybe it'll give some new motivations for different hidden sectors and new physics, et cetera. And more importantly, just obviously the standard model is a single point on this space. And so it's interesting to understand what are the other QFTs that are related to this point and how that could help us understand collider physics. So, and also given that the standard model is an IR description, effective description, we want to know if we can constrain the UV in some way. So some constraints already, of course, exist. We know we can compute what A is for the standard model, and then we know that whatever A is in the UV, it's larger. But of course, that's not particularly useful for model building because that's basically just the statement that we can take whatever building blocks we're accustomed to, some weakly coupled fields, and we can add them as we want, and we can make as baroque UV construction as possible. But maybe there are more constraints. Okay, so, all right. Okay, so to get a foothold on what's going on, it's useful to pick some particular reference point, and I'll take it to be a CFT. Okay, these are sort of the most generic kind of special points, right, because they have the additional symmetries of the CFT. And I'll work in four dimensions throughout this talk. Maybe there are some analogs for some of these statements in other dimensions, I don't know. But basically, the CFT data is just a collection of simple numbers. So it's a collection of OPE coefficients, which I've written as FO, O prime. And it's a collection of, you know, a list of operator dimensions, basically. So if you take some primary in the CFT, so primary O, this is some operator that you use to build the representations of the conformal group, and you take O with its conjugate, you get some OPE. The first term is just determines the normalization of O. It's just the two-point function. And then the higher terms just indicate the appearance of higher dimensional conformal primaries and also their various descendants. And these FOO prime are in some sense a measure of the interaction strength of the OPE, right? Of the conformal field theory. They sort of measure how O and O bar fuse together to form O prime. So some of the particularly useful data of the CFT describes collective behavior. So examples include the two-point function coefficients and the ANC anomalies. So the two-point function coefficients of currents, tau ij, are useful because they describe the way the CFT, the collective behavior of the CFT, in response to a weakly coupled external gauge field. And the ANC anomalies are useful because they tell you about how the theory responds to some external metric. And knowing something about the collective behavior is important because that's probably data that will affect the renormalization group flow. But the point is that this data, again, is not random. It's very tightly constrained. So one very basic constraint is unitarity applied to the two-point functions of the theory. So for example, tau ij. So tau ij, again, just ours. These are basically two-point functions of currents. You have some tensor structure, some appropriate power of x, and the tau ij are just the overall factors that are not determined by conformal invariance alone. There's some numbers. And the C is just the same thing for the stress tensor. And they're positive by unitarity. These are real operators, and so their two-point functions are positive. So that's kind of the most basic constraint. So C is positive, tau ij is a positive definite matrix. Another set of constraints comes from, and the three-point functions I should note are just basically the OPE coefficients. The four-point functions are extremely non-trivial because they're the first function whose space-time dependence is not fixed by the conformal group. And knowing constraints on the four-point function then can lead to some very interesting additional constraints on the CFT. So this has been done. This is the bootstrap program, essentially, that was initiated by these various authors. And so what you do is you just write down the four-point function of operators in the CFT. So I'll just take them all to be some scalars phi with dimension d. Then conformal invariance basically fixes this four-point function to have this form up to some function g of these two conformally invariant cross ratios, u and v. But this function g uv is arbitrary in quotation marks. I mean, it's not really arbitrary, as we'll see. But it's not fixed by conformal invariance directly. So this guy, guv, has to obey certain constraints. And that's because I can simply switch, if you like, x1 and x2, or x1 and x3. And if I'm careful in this formula, then under these transformations, G transforms in this way. So GUV is under x1, x2 is this, and under x1, x3 is that. Now, also, you can imagine, so we can go back to this, this four-point function, we can imagine evaluating it by considering the OPE of phi at x1 with phi at x2, and separately phi at x3 with phi at x4. So these guys sort of fuse together to phi 1 and phi 2 fuse together and give you some primary that with coefficient dictated by the OP. And this primary is then, and its descendants are then emitted to phi 4 and phi 3 who absorb it with, again, with some coefficient given by the OP. Now, So you have this relation here. So this GUV has this form where I've isolated the contribution from the identity operator, and then the GO are the basically the contributions from the O operators and their descendants for all the other operators appearing in the OPE. So these appear with positive coefficients if you choose an appropriate real basis. And the fact that this should be, that I can do the OPE in the channel phi 1, phi 2, or in the channel phi 1, phi 4, basically this crossing symmetry, tells me that this GUV obeys some highly non-trivial constraints. In particular, if I write this picture out in equations, it's just this equation here. So you have essentially built out of the GUVs with some positive real coefficients, you have some function that has to sum up to 1. So in the space of functions of 2 variables, this is a very non-trivial geometrical statement. These are vectors, if you like, in that infinite space. And this is the identity operator vector. And there are some positive coefficients. So basically what you're saying is that this, the vector for this identity operator in this space has to lie inside a cone spanned by the vectors for the other primaries. And it's extremely non-trivial to solve this, this constraint. And you get many interesting, really interesting constraints from this. Are there any questions so far? Okay, so many beautiful results follow from this. One, that the initial motivating result was actually a particle physics one. It was basically to understand whether the H dagger H term, the mass term for the Higgs, whether one could make it parametrically small using conformal technicolor. And basically that was the question of, so these guys formalized that question by saying that by putting bounds on the dimension of this operator. So in conformal technicolor, you want this dimension, the dimension of this operator to be large. But these authors showed that there's some non-trivial upper bound, in fact, that follows simply from applying this logic to the four-point function of scalar operators. But for us, the most important constraints are basically the following. So one, this should read F. These three-point function coefficients, these interaction strengths, if you like, are bounded. They cannot be arbitrarily large. So in particular, all the OPE coefficients are bounded by some universal function that depends on the dimensions of the operators on the left-hand side of the OPE, phi, this is dimension D, and the operators that appear on the right-hand side, delta. Okay. So a CFT is essentially, in some sense, smooth. It can't be arbitrarily strongly coupled, if you like, in this sense. The second important constraint is basically that the conformal anomaly C is also bounded. So in other words, unitarity alone simply tells you that C should be positive. It's the coefficient of a two-point function. But it doesn't say anything about how small it could be. You could imagine that it could be as small as you want. But actually, from the bootstrap, we know that that's not the case. So that's basically equivalent to saying, if you like, that there must be some minimal amount of matter present in any unitary CFT. So this was derived by these various authors, Poland and Simms Duffin and Ratazzi, Richkov, and Vicky, roughly at the same time. finally, there are another interesting set of constraints by Hoffman and Maldacena in 2008. And what these gentlemen did basically is they considered this setup called conformal collider physics. And essentially what they did was they imagined that you insert some local operator at some point, and then you have some idealized calorimeters infinitely far away, and you measure basically the energy flux through these calorimeters. So more technically, your theory has some stress tensor, Ti. You measure the integrated energy, dt, with respect to some angle, theta. So this is some unit vector in R3. And in particular, what they studied was they studied correlators, really basically just the one-point function of these energy flux operators in the state created by insertions of this local operator O. So this operator O is inserted there in the blue spot. And this is what they computed. And what they showed is essentially if you, the one-point function physically, it makes sense that it should be something positive, right? I mean, the energy deposited in the calorimeter at infinity should be something positive. And so follows from that that if you consider these one-point functions in the states created by the stress tensor, and when you have supersymmetry, the stress tensor's various supersymmetric friends, including the R current, what you find is a bunch of constraints on the ratios of A over C. So you find, for example, that for N equals 0 theories, A over C has to be bigger than a third and less than 31 over 18. And then you find sort of more restrictive theories as you add more supersymmetry. So in particular, yeah, for n equals 2 theories, there's this very restrictive bound. For n equals 4 theories, it's not very interesting. It's just equal to 1. Okay, so this is the CFT. It has these interesting constraints. Now what we want to do is we want to discuss the RG flow. So CFTs are useful basically because they describe the endpoints of RG flows. At least in two dimensions, it's clear. Basically, if you assume certain things like unitarity, things like that, then you basically find that this statement is true. In four dimensions, it's a more open-ended question. In any case, it's quite clear that if you have interacting non-conformal fixed points, that they are very special. So essentially, you have CFTs in the UV and the IR. And in between, you can have obviously extremely complicated phenomena. So you can have accidental symmetries. You can have emergent phenomena, right? You can have, you start from some UV fixed point, you deform it by a relevant operator. Then in the IR, you could find something completely different, like in QCD, right, where you find in the UV quarks and gluons, and in the IR, you find just pions, basically. So you can have confinement, chiral symmetry breaking, all this jazz. And in particular, you can identify universal CFT quantities, and you can try to use them to constrain the RG flow. So examples of this include, since the 80s, we've known about that in two dimensions, C is larger than the UV than the IR. In three dimensions, we have this F theorem. And in four dimensions, we have this result involving A. So of course, one question is if there's a more general picture of the theory on SD. So the generalization seems to be in even dimensions. When you appropriately regulate the theory, you put the CFT on some D sphere, and you appropriately regulate it, then the logarithmically divergent piece is basically the generalization of A. And in odd dimensions, it's basically just the constant piece. So also, if you have more symmetry, then you can potentially say more. So sometimes there are partners. There are additional quantities when the theory has supersymmetry, or in particular R symmetry, that allow you to define some sort of reference currents that you can use to compare objects in the ultraviolet and the infrared. But just morally, CFT constraints from OPE associativity, conformal collider physics, and all this stuff should also constrain things away from criticality. At least if we're sort of, in some sense, in a nearby patch of theory space. Because after all, we saw that those OPE coefficients that we found in the CFT are, not arbitrarily large. So we'll argue that this is true, at least in basically certain special kinds of theories. Right. So basically what we want to do is we want to study the distribution of superconformal field theories in the space of theories. So in particular, for supersymmetric RG flows with differing amounts of supersymmetry, we want to know if there's some minimal length of the RG flow. Okay, and I'll try to make that precise in a second. So as I said, what we want to know is how repulsive superconformal field theories are under the RG flow. So how far away TUV and TIR are. And of course, we have to be careful, right? Because we don't want some coordinate-dependent distance. We don't want something that depends on the scheme. We want to say something invariant about the length. Now, as a note, whenever you have supersymmetry, there's a good chance that you also have things called conformal manifolds. So these are basically manifolds of fixed points that are related to each other by some exactly marginal deformations. So in n equals 1 supersymmetry, you have super QCD with 2NC flavors. You have some quartic terms that, if you choose them appropriately, correspond to directions along the conformal manifold. And in n equals 2 theory, of course, you have the gauge coupling, which very often can be exactly marginal. But what we're going to do is we're going to study this question by introducing a length scale into the problem, right? So we're not concerned about that fact. We want to sort of understand, we want to study directions normal to the conformal manifold and understand if there's some kind of notion of minimal distance. So the basic intuition is the following. The intuition is that the less supersymmetric the theory is, the richer the dynamics can be in the vicinity of TUV, right? So the more stuff that can kind of counteract the addition of relevant deformation, and the more likely it is that the RG flow can come to a stop in the same patch of theory space, or at least very close by. So in pictures, if you imagine that you have some TUV and some TIR, and the flow is minimally supersymmetric, it preserves some n equals 1 theory, you would think that it's possible to find some parametrically close IR fixed point. If the theory has more supersymmetry, you expect that the dynamics is more constrained and that you kind of need some other patch, some non-perturbatively related patch of theory space to bring the RG flow to a halt. But of course, what we have to do is we have to be careful. We have to define what we mean by distance, right? I mean, that's not a very clear thing. This is an infinite dimensional space. But at least conformal field theories themselves and neighborhoods of conformal field theories have a natural metric. It's the Zamolodchikov metric. So this is basically a metric for primaries in the theory. So I'll take these OIs to be some real operators, some Hermitian operators. And the two-point functions are just then positive definite by unitarity. And it's very non-trivial, of course, to take this metric and extend it away to something that makes sense globally. And maybe there are better metrics that make sense globally. But at least locally, you can sort of compute radiative corrections to this in some particular way, and answers should make sense. So one possible definition of distance is that you can imagine, at least if the infrared theory is sort of sufficiently close by, namely that it can be written in terms of some UV operators with small changes in the couplings, you imagine that you could take the metric and its corrections in the vicinity of the UV fixed point, and you could sandwich it with some differentials in the space of theories, and you could then compute some integral of this object along some length minimizing geodesic in the space of theories. So this quantity, of course, computing such a geodesic is non-trivial, but this quantity is basically scheme independent because it doesn't depend on coordinates. So if the theory is sufficiently close by, then you expect also that you can sort of approximate this result by just taking roughly the metric at the fixed point multiplied by these various small deformations. And presumably, this definition is well-defined for some universal distance. If you take any TIR that's within some universal positive distance of TUV, this is presumably well-defined, because otherwise something has to break down, right? Otherwise, you would find that this definition is not well defined for arbitrarily small distances, right? And we've seen already that OPE coefficients themselves can't be infinite. They're bounded, they're well behaved. And also beta functions, really, in this scheme independent sense, measured with a metric, also can't blow up when you get to a CFT. They flow to zero. So it's not clear how to extend this globally, but it's not gonna matter for this question of trying to determine lower bounds, okay? Right, so for large distances, these expressions generally break down. You move to a new patch, right? So if this is the super QCD, electric super QCD, in the free magnetic range, and at this pole, then at the other pole, there's the magnetic super QCD, and you have to sort of transition to some new coordinates to get to that other point. But another good measure of distance, of course, is the change in the A anomaly. So it's well-defined, of course, absolutely scheme-independent. And it has the advantage that it can often be measured in different patches of theory space by duality, right? So here we have some dual description in this patch of super QCD. We can measure A here and here, and we can then compare. You have to be careful because there are some sort of, if you want, examples where the change in A is zero, but these can be understood kind of as theories where you have some decoupled scalar, effectively, that interacts with the rest of the CFT by some highly irrelevant operators, so that when you turn on a VEV for this field, you still only get irrelevant operators in the action. But anyway, these are special cases. So a slightly more precise question is just, for differing amounts of supersymmetry along the RG flow, can we find theories with parametrically small delta A and D? Okay. So I should note that this D, of course, is also defined for normal for motion along a conformal manifold. Delta A is invariant along in that motion. But anyway, we'll just sort of restrict to normal directions. And these bounds are also clearly related, right? Because I can't make D parametrically small. I can't make these fixed points parametrically close to each other and have the change in A be be finite, because then that simply doesn't work by continuity. Or if you want more precisely, you can relate the change in A in the vicinity of a fixed point to the square of the beta functions, which is basically just this quantity here. And it can't be the case that this quantity goes to zero, but this but the square of the beta function stays finite. So a so this is a slightly more precise question. And right, so if we can establish, for example, bounds on delta A, then that implies also bounds on D. But the opposite direction, of course, is harder to prove, and I don't have a good proof for that. That might be true, for example, if the A, if there's some analog of Zamolodchikov's C function, where you have some sort of function that interpolates in the space of couplings that only depends on the RG scale through the couplings, that is in some sense not fine-tuned, then you could probably also conclude that the converse holds. Okay, so the general setup again, so we start from some superconformal field theory. Unitarity essentially constrains the relevant deformations to be deformations of the superpotential. So these are some operators OI, gauge invariant operators OI, that have dimensions 3 minus delta I, where delta I is the deviation from marginality. And I'll just suppose that this relevant deformation is dominant, so that any VEVs that you might turn on, these are sort of subleading effects in the ultraviolet. So of course, for the n equals 4 example, when we study motion on the moduli space, then we'll, I mean, that example's simple, this assumption won't hold. And okay, there are also other RG flows in n equals 2, right, where you just turn on a VEV, but I won't discuss those here. So the UV physics in particular is controlled by OPEs. So you have some operators OI with O dagger J. And for the supersymmetric theory, it's very simple. I'll take the Zamolodchikov metric to be unit normalized. And then you have some interesting contributions to the OP arising from currents. So these JA, these are so-called moment maps, if you like, in more particle physics terminology. They're D terms for global symmetry currents that the O's are charged under. And these TAI J bar are essentially, they're essentially, they give you the corresponding charges of the O's. And they're weighted basically by some, they're divided by some size of the current, the two-point function of the current. And then similarly, you have some non-conserved currents. These are operators Li of dimension larger than 2. So the D terms are dimension 2 for conserved currents. And then you have operators of dimension larger than 2. They have some anomalous dimension that also enter. And you have their various descendants. So descendants of this operator include the currents and the conserved currents, and these operators include non-conserved currents. Are there any questions at all? Or? Okay. So so again, the smoothness of this physics implies that if we want to look for some sort of short RG flow, we should look for RG flows that are initiated by almost marginal relevant deformations, right? Because if we take some highly marginal deformation and we add it to the theory, then that operator has to flow to something basically, if you like, relevant or irrelevant in the infrared. And this change in dimensions can't occur for arbitrarily short distances in theory space. So furthermore, since we're doing something supersymmetric, the IR theory has to have a superconformal R symmetry, right? The partner of the stress tensor that gives you dimensions of chiral operators. And so there should be some R symmetry that's kind of visible in the theory, or at least approximately visible. So the simplest example is that you take a single U1 current in the UV, I'll call it U, and you assign O some charge epsilon under U. So this gives some R symmetry. So you can use this operator to construct an R symmetry. So this breaks the superconformal R symmetry of the UV theory, but you can use this additional epsilon to construct a conserved R symmetry. And yeah, so this gives you some hope of finding some perturbative solutions with small d, and also small a if you assume something about this decreasing a function. So what you do is you can just then calculate. You can use this OPE, and you can impose some cutoff in superspace, and you get some beta functions. You just insert this guy. You know, this guy gets inserted in correlation functions. And then you regulate collisions of these operator oi, and you can compute some beta function using this prescription. And you find the leading order term, of course, is minus epsilon lambda. This is the tree level term plus some one loop term that's cubic because basically of some non-renormalization properties of supersymmetry. And it's weighted by epsilon squared and tau u, the two-point function of u. So immediately OPE coefficient bounds tell you something slightly interesting, basically that finding a fixed point at parametrically small lambda, at least in this case, means that the OPE, that you shouldn't rely basically on large coefficients here from the OPE because these are bounded. These are bounded quantities. So in this scheme where you can work with parametrically small lambda, you find that d is basically very small. So d, the distance in coupling constant space, is tau u over epsilon to the 1/2. And if tau u is some power of epsilon with epsilon to the n, with n bigger than 1 or less than or equal to 2, d naught can be parametrically small. And this upper bound follows, again, from the bootstrap. So you can similarly compute the change in A. The change in A is essentially just the integral of d lambda beta, basically beta squared d log mu. And this is just, at leading order in conformal perturbation theory, is just the two-point function of u. So beta squared is basically, beta is essentially the trace of the stress tensor. Beta squared essentially comes from the two-point function of t's in perturbation theory. And so it's natural to assume that u should somehow be related to the stress tensor. And indeed, that's true. So u is indeed related to the trace anomaly. So it turns out to be the case that this u is related precisely to the R symmetry that's conserved along the RG flow. So it satisfies some equation, at least in certain theories, that looks like equation 19. And in conformal perturbation theory, it's always fine to write this equation. So if the physics is particularly well behaved, and you can trust your solution, you have some parametrically small lambda, and you can then trust the solution, you have some parametrically small deviation from marginality, you can compute delta A exactly. It has some one loop term, and then it has some higher order corrections, basically the Tuft anomaly of this operator U, of the symmetry U in the UV theory. If you have more flavor symmetries preserved, then you need to maximize the anomaly functional for the R current in order to compute the corresponding U. And the one issue is that in n equals 2 theories, generally there's no candidate to insert into this expression because there's no such operator, but at least formally in conformal perturbation theory, you can still define a U operator in n equals 2 theories simply by the demanding that it's orthogonal to the conserved flavor currents. So this is some object that naturally appears around n equals 2 fixed points. More generally, you have to take into account, of course, accidental symmetries, and this is hard. These are basically symmetry currents that have anomalous dimensions. So they have dimension 3 plus gamma, where gamma is some positive number, and it's very hard to do in general. As we'll see, I won't give you all the details, but at least in n equals 2 theories, you can see that certain classes of accidental symmetries will never contribute to the infrared R symmetry. Okay, so for n equals 1 theories, the results are pretty straightforward. So the intuition is basically, so for if you give me, of course, or anybody, some positive real number R, then it's always possible to construct some RG flow such that the change in A or D, if you like, this geodesic distance we discussed is parametrically smaller than A. So the simplest example you might think about would be the banked Zaks flow. So this is simply, you take, this is the n equals 1 supersymmetric version of the RG flow of Banks and Zaks. So you take basically SUNC with gauge theory with NF equals N flavors, and you demand that you take the limit of large NC, large N, where basically the ratio is fixed to be very close to asymptotic freedom, just slightly asymptotically free. Then you can compute the one loop beta function, and you find some tree level contribution that's of order 1, and then you find some higher loop contribution. But in this case, delta A cannot be parametrically small. Okay, and the reason that it can't be parametrically small is that when you compute delta A, you insert some, there's some insertion of this Zamolodchikov metric I was telling you about, and that Zamolodchikov metric precisely diverges at short distances. So even though beta is parametrically small, the Zamolodchikov metric enhances UV contributions in such a way that the change in A is something of order 1. It's n squared epsilon squared. So epsilon is always of order 1 over n. So this object change in A is always, can never be made parametrically small in this case. So this, and the distance, this geodesic distance d, is also divergent. So what we should do, basically, is we should study theories where where the Zamolodchikov metric is well defined. Okay. So we shouldn't study theories with free gauge fields in UV and IR because those theories will never be parametrically close to each other. So a simple example where everything works is to take adjoint super QCD. So you imagine adding an additional adjoint chiral superfield X, and you again take NCN and F to infinity, and this time you take X to be very close to a half, slightly larger. X is basically the ratio of NC over NF, as in the previous slide. So this is very close to being asymptotically free again. And you imagine adding an additional scalar, okay? And this additional scalar you add to the superpotential in this way. You can check using A maximization that this deformation, phi trace X squared, where this is the adjoint and this is the decoupled scalar phi, has dimension that's very close to 3, and you can then, but slightly less, and you can check that the change in A then is parametrically small. And the reason, the heuristic reason that it's parametrically small is that you essentially only excite 1 degree of freedom at leading order. Basically, the quantum effects of this RG flow are just captured in the change in the anomalous dimension of phi. These other degrees of freedom are basically inert. And similarly, this distance, this geodesic distance, is also parametrically small. So now you can wonder, what about n equals to 2 theories? So the first thing to guess at is to what happens to the Banach-Zaks theories when you have n equals to 2 supersymmetry, okay? So the first thing to notice, of course, is that the beta function in n equals 2 theories is one loop exact. So there are many ways to say that, as long as the renormalization group scheme preserves n equals 2 supersymmetry, it's one loop exact. The hypermultiplets, if you think in the NSVZ beta function with the gamma, the anomalous dimension of the matter fields, these things vanish in n equals 2 because they're related to conserved currents, which have vanishing anomalous dimension. But there's also a very simple alternative argument. When you start with some UNR symmetry that's chiral, even in an n equals 2 case, in the sense that it assigns charge, same charge to Q and Q twiddle in the hypermultiplet. When you turn on the coupling, of course, we only have non-chiral symmetries present. You have the SU2R, you have the various flavor symmetries. And so no matter what candidate R current you try to construct for the theory that describes the infrared, you'll always find that its anomalies vanish. And so you would conclude that AIR equals CIR equals 0, which is not allowed by unitarity. It's not allowed by the bootstrap or anything like that. So it would imply that you'd have some trivial theory in the IR, which clearly can't be the case. So to understand how general this statement is, it's useful just to introduce a few concepts. So I'll just run through some of the points. I won't dwell on too many of the details. So are there any questions at this point? Okay. So an n equals 2 superconformal field theory has basically an SU2R times U1R symmetry. So this is the overall superconformal U1R, at least if the theory has only one sector. If it has many decoupled sectors, then it has similar currents in every sector. And there can also be some flavor symmetry and maybe some higher spin symmetries if the theory is free. But one particularly interesting symmetry in this combination of SU2R times U1R is called, I'll call it just J. And this is just a flavor symmetry from the perspective of the n equals 1 theory. So it's some linear combination of the overall superconformal UNR called R n equals 2 and with the sigma 3 generator of SU2R. And so its moment map, the D term for this operator, is just the lowest component of the multiplet which contains the R currents and the stress tensor, this dimension 2 multiplet J, which is an SU2R singlet, that is annihilated by this combination of the superspace derivatives of n equals 2, I and J are SU2R indices. On the other hand, flavor currents reside in multiplets also of dimension 2, but SU2R charge 1. So these are multiplets L, I, J that satisfy this reality condition. They're symmetric. and they satisfy this condition in superspace, basically that these totally symmetric derivatives vanish. So you can just check that, for example, the 2-2 component of this multiplet is just some chiral superfield mu. It's annihilated by D1. And you can check that the L12 component is just some real moment map. So mu is sometimes called also a holomorphic moment map. And for a Lagrangian theory, just to orient yourself, if you've never seen this before, this operator mu is some bilinear of the fields QQ twiddle. It's a mass term, if you like, for these fields. And JF is just the operator Q, the D term, QQ daggers minus Q tilde dagger. And this is the basis of this claim that the hypermultiplet has vanishing anomalous dimension, because basically the anomalous dimension of this guy is zero because it's related to this current. So these currents don't act on partners of vectors. They just act on the matter fields. There's an invariant way of saying that. But basically, yeah, you can couple them to gauge fields. So this is the n equals 2 gauge field with gauge multiple at v, and then n equals 1 partner superfield phi. So if you gauge in an n equals 1 sense this symmetry, you add a gauge field v, and you add an interaction to the superpotential involving phi and mu. So on the other hand, this operator j is universal in some sense. I mean, just in the Lagrangian theory, if you like, it acts on all the degrees of freedom, the partners of the gauge superfield phi, and also the matter fields. More generally, the point is that the two-point function of J is, I mean, it's in a multiplet with the stress tensor, and it's just related to C. And so it gives a measure of the total number of degrees of freedom at the UV fixed point. It's just essentially up to some order one number I don't care about. It's just C. OK, so now there's some technical complications that I'm not going to delve into very much. But basically, unitarity constraints and the n equals 2 superconformal algebra place some very tight restrictions on low-dimensional operators in these kinds of theories. So we want to study, again, based on our general discussion, theories with almost marginal operators that are relevant in order to have a chance to find small d and, under reasonable assumptions, small a. So these kinds of operators can occur, for example, in Argyris-Douglas theories. They can occur if you take the 2-0 theory and reduce it on a sphere with an irregular puncture, say. And what you can basically, that these types of deformations are constrained by unitarity in this algebra to have this form, to be basically some kind of prepotential deformation. The other operators are either relevant or not interesting. They break more symmetries, which is also interesting in some way. I'll get to that in the conclusions. I won't tell you what the answers are when you break n equals 2 to n equals 1, but I won't tell you the details. But the point is that this basically constrains these deformations to look like this. Okay, so now you might wonder, okay, so can we do the same thing that we had before? So we had, in the n equals 1 case, we had the analog, right? We had the n equals 1 chiral deformation that flowed to something that was parametrically close by. So can we do the same thing for n equals 2? The answer is no, and there are a couple ways to see it. One way follows from the bootstrap, and the other way follows from Hoffman-Maldacena plus some additional formulas that were sort of proven by, Tachikawa and Shapir and conjectured, I guess, originally by Argyris and Wittig. But the basic idea is that if you this deformation breaks the symmetry J, and in fact that's the only thing that it breaks. I mean, it doesn't break any flavor symmetries, basically, because you can study the OPE of these deformations, and using SU2R quantum numbers, you can check that there's no other thing that's broken. So this operator that I defined at the beginning, U, is basically just this partner of the stress tensor, and so in particular, the change in A that you compute at leading order, the change in A that you compute at leading order in the n equals 2 theory is just given by this with tau j, which is just, as we said, C up to some overall number, right? Now, C, as we saw in the bootstrap constraints, cannot be parametrically small, okay? So in other words, the change in A itself cannot be parametrically small in conformal perturbation theory. Now, so that's one way to say it. The bootstrap constraints the RG flow in this way. Another way to say it is, I won't give you the details because it's more technical, involving the Hoffman and Mollis center bounds. There's some expression basically for linear combinations of A and C involving, if you like, Coulomb branch or generalized Coulomb branch operator. You can use that plus Hoffman and Mollis center to say something similar about the change in A. But again, this can't be the whole story. Again, you don't have, there's no obvious candidate for the superconformal R current because you don't have the correct quantum numbers. It needs to have particular quantum numbers under SU2R. But so you might imagine, I mean, so there has to be some kind of accidental symmetry. But the point is that the accidental symmetries that can occur in N equals 2 theories, if they're basically not badly broken in the UV, so if they're operators that could contribute, if you like, at some nearby fixed point, the basic point is that they can be ruled out because they have a very specific form based on the structure of N equals 2 current multiplets. They basically have to come from a bunch of almost decoupled sectors. And you can show, it's very easy to show, it's just a simple exercise in N equals 2 representation theory and dimensions of operators to show that these guys can't contribute in the IR. So whatever can contribute in the IR in N equals 2 theory is something with dimension that's parametrically different, well, that's different than 3. It's something that cannot be made, it's some symmetry that is not, that has dimension that's not parametrically close to 3. Okay? So again, the distance from the UV to the IR fixed point, if the fixed points are to be parametrically close to each other, I mean, the fixed points can't be parametrically close to each other because somehow the theory has to overcome this non-trivial, this non-parametrically small gamma universal. So as a result, in these N equals 2 RG flows, you can check that this D can't be parametrically small. And if you assume that there is such a thing as a non-fine-tuned decreasing A function, you can also check that the same holds for delta A. And you can also check many examples. I mean, I don't have a proof of this last statement. But if you can also check many examples, and you can see that this holds also for delta A. So the final question is just, what about the maximally symmetric theories? So the maximally symmetric theories are much easier, basically, as long as there are no exotic manifestations of N equals 4 supersymmetry. For the N equals 4 RG flow, the only thing you can do is move out on the moduli space. This introduces a mass scale. It Higgs is some generator and some gives masses to some corresponding hypermultiplets. And in the UV, you have just some simple expression for A. I mean, you have a conformal manifold, so you can always evaluate A at the free fixed point. And you just find something that depends on the gauge group G in this way. And in going to the IR, of course, you have to lose at least one generator. And so, of course, the steps in delta A must be discrete. They can't be parametrically small. This is not so interesting. It's much more constrained than the N equals 4 theory. Similarly, you can check that mass terms that break N equals 1, N equals 4 to N equals 1, or N equals 2, render massive a large number of degrees of freedom. Intuitively, this is just because, again, you can go to the almost free theory, and you can see that basically adding these mass terms just corresponds to integrating out a macroscopic amount of stuff. Okay? So what we've argued is that these delta A and D can't be parametrically small for N equals 2 theories. The question, one interesting question is, can we actually find some real numerical bounds? So these are some existence arguments, but the question is if it can be actually made into something, if you can actually find a concrete lower bound, some, if you like, some bootstrap program for the RG flow. So we also argued that approximately conserved currents can't mix with the IR superconformal R-current, but it'd be nice to find a bound exactly on what this anomalous dimension is that makes it approximately non-conserved. And finally, I didn't mention it here, but you can check that parametrically close N equals 1 fixed points are allowed, basically if the UV theory is N equals 2, basically under the assumption of a single stress tensor and some flavor symmetry in the UV. You can show that this is possible essentially if the UV central charges are not too large, basically compared to some of the data in the theory, in particular the inverse deviation of these marginally relevant operators from the inverse of the deviation from marginality of these almost marginal relevant deformations. Okay, so that's it. Thanks.
You have concepts of some Yeah.
I mean, so here, so for example, so let's say this, for the change in the A anomaly, there's no reason, I think, there's no close relationship between this RG time, let's say, and the change in A. Also, I mean, this, here, I mean, if you like, on this, along this, in this parametrization here, what you could imagine is you just, you know, you divide by d log mu squared, right? And you get some d log mu in front, and then it's also, if you like, some function of this RG time. But I mean, in general, this RG time is infinite, right? I mean, it's so it's if you like, you could write this expression in terms of that time, I guess.
Yeah, but usually one thinks of the theory in terms, one way to think about the theory.
Right.
This, by the way, is also a way to extend the arguments to different number of dimensions in a continuous way, for instance.
Right.
So I was thinking about if there was any precise relationship which could.
Well, I don't know, except that it enters in this expression, but I mean, it can if you want. I mean, you can put in a time. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I haven't thought about three dimensions at all. I mean, probably, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if it's simpler for any reason or less. Yeah, I don't know.